there's some things that the manufacturers are doing to continue to you know, serve the cleaning industry in this area. And there's a chemical response that they're doing. They're trying to make molecules that have a reactive place in the molecule. You know, when they remove the freons, the thing about the freons is they were so inert that they lasted a long time in the environment, made their way up to the ozone layer. And so they've come back with other molecules that are a little more reactive, and so they get chewed up by oxygen. But if those molecules contribute to photochemical smog, then they're labeled VOCs. And so then they continue to do chemistry and figure out other molecules that react faster than ethylene. That's the benchmark for the smog-producing molecules. And if they react faster than that, then there's a chance that they could be VOC exempt. And so there's a chemical answer to that, and there's still innovation going on at the big solvent manufacturers trying to make creative chemical responses to those VOC regulations. But that's pretty difficult, and if those solvents happen to be produced in small volume, then that means they're very expensive.
That's my guest, Dr. Darren Williams, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Dr. Williams has been at Sam Houston State University since 2004, teaching physical chemistry, forensic chemistry, and graduate courses in spectroscopy and thermodynamics. He came to Huntsville from the U.S. Department of Energy Pantex plant in Amarillo. He taught at West Texas A&M University for 4 years after obtaining his Ph.D. from Oregon State University in 1997. He is originally from Fort Worth and obtained his B.S. in chemistry from the University of Texas at Austin in 1992. Darren Williams, thank you for joining me on Reliability Matters. I really appreciate you being my guest today.
I'm glad to be here. This is going to be great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. I just today, about an hour ago, finished an interview with two of your colleagues, your partners in crime, for your upcoming, and we're going to get into this in more detail in a little bit, but you have an upcoming workshop for working engineers called the Product Quality Cleaning Workshop. And you and two of your colleagues, Barbara and Ed Kaningsburg, affectionately known as the cleaning lady and the rocket scientist, get together with the professor and produce this cleaning workshop, which we're going to get into in a minute. But first, I got a couple of questions about you specifically.
Okay, great.
You specialize in cleaning, and how did you, you know, I'm in the cleaning world, so I think of everything in through the lens of cleaning, you know, whether I'm staying at a hotel or eating at a restaurant, you know, that's one of the legacies when you're in this world. But how did you get started? How did you gravitate toward that specialty?
Yeah, that's a great question, because as an academic, you know, it's just not in the standard curriculum for anything that I can think of. I'm in the chemistry department, so I teach chemistry classes, and that's the way I was trained as well, PhD in physical chemistry, spectroscopy. And my first job outside of academia was with the Department of Energy Pantex plant up in Amarillo. And the first project I was put on was to sort of set up and arrange a cleaning conference. And so that was my first introduction, was this precision cleaning conference that the Department of Energy held at Pantex. And we brought in engineers and scientists from Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore, Sandia National Labs, different other plants like Kansas City plant and Idaho National Labs. And it was amazing. So it really sparked my interest in an applied field of chemistry as it relates to precision cleaning. So that was my first introduction, and that was in 1998.
Wow, you've been...
Actually, that was when I took a job there in 2000, but my first projects with them was as early as 98, yes.
I read something on your bio that just stood out, and it totally requires an explanation. One of the things in your bio is the prediction of the spectroscopy of aged explosives. That is interesting. What's that about?
Well, that was, again, part of that job at Pantex. That is the Department of Energy facility. It's a government-owned and contracted operator facility. And what they do is they maintain the nation's nuclear stockpile. So it's a
wow.
kind of an exotic place to work. It took some getting used to, you know, going through all of the security and everything sure. every day going to work. But each component agency in that area of national security is responsible for monitoring the age of the components that they make. And so in the nuclear stockpile, you have different contractors that make the different parts. And the Pantex plant makes the chemical explosives, the pressed explosives. And so part of our job is in surveillance of the those devices was to take devices out of the field, pull out the explosives, and look for signatures of age, and to make sure that they were as safe today as they were when they were manufactured.
Do they become less stable when they're at an advanced age? Or is that the whole idea is to ensure they are still stable and all the other attributes?
Yeah, that's the key, that these pressed explosives were remarkably stable. I was pretty surprised as a chemist looking at these. We had to do quite a bit to them in order, like the lab samples, in order to see signatures of aging. So we would heat them up in containers with, you know, high humidity and so on, just to see any kind of breakdown signatures. So we did a lot of accelerated aging studies.
That is one of my favorite topics, is accelerated aging. In the world of electronics and cleanliness quantification, I think the closest thing to a time machine is to put yes. a board in an oven under heat and humidity and bias and run it for 1,000 hours. You know, give it several years of age and see how it performs. So many people test their product for cleanliness under the most ideal laboratory conditions. and they don't really see what the future holds. So if you really want to see how a product is going to behave after it is in the field for so long, you accelerate yes. age it. And that's something that our industry is starting to adopt now. In fact, our industry's standard setting organization is called IPC, and they just redid the cleaning quantification procedures. They used to, many years ago, publish a number. It was a specific test called the Rose test, resistivity of solvent yes. extract test. And they said, many years ago in the 70s, someone said, hey, I think 10 micrograms of sodium equivalent per square inch is dirty and 9.9 is clean. So people would get a 9.9 and they go, woof, we almost failed, ship it. But no one ever yeah. asked the question, where does your product go? What does it do? What is its cost of failure? What is yes. the environmental climactic environment where it's going to be? And they just came up with a random number. To me, the most common question I get asked as a quote-unquote cleaning professional in the electronics industry is, well, how clean is clean enough? And, you know, I always respond the same way. You got an hour? Sit down. And yeah, I need to ask you at least a dozen questions before I can even hope to come up with a number or a method to determine if your boards are clean. Because it all is contextual, right?
Yes.
You know, if you're dealing with aged explosives, that's one thing. If you're dealing with an electronic flea caller, that's another thing, you know?
Yes,
so I imagine in your world, well beyond, you know, much wider than electronics, that probably still applies, right?
Yes, and you can imagine my excitement being there as a chemist, because, you know, I saw the chemicals that were involved. The engineers were looking at, you know, the engineering properties. And it was my first introduction into a real team-based approach for solving problems. I mean, it was a marvelous place to work. But I came back to academia just to get closer to family and because I love teaching. But I brought all of that knowledge of accelerated aging, solvent substitution, cleanliness verification that we did as a part of our work there at Pantex. And I just made it my area of expertise here and have tried to work with the Koenigsbergs to make more contacts in industry. And so that's where we are today, studying cleaning and cleaning science here at the university and trying to, you know, contract with folks to chase down their rabbits.
Right, exactly. Follow them down that hole. You put something out on LinkedIn today. I love all your LinkedIn stuff. You know, you really promote cleaning and of course, the workshop coming up. One of the things you put on LinkedIn today was an image, and on the text on the image was, how do you capture your cleaning process? And capture was italicized. So that was curious to me. What do you mean by capturing your cleaning process?
Well, if you think about it, you know, there's quite a few parts to a cleaning process. And so there's, you know, when I'm thinking of capturing your cleaning process, I mean, do you grasp all of its characteristics? It's not just a solvent. It's not just a detergent. You know, it's not just ultrasonic energy, but it's everything that goes around that. So I guess grasp or capture, do you understand the whole process?
Got it.
What the parts bring in with them and what they take away with them and what's following your process. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. So in my world, in the electronics industry, we've become a bit gentrified in our industry, not as many young people as I'd like to see entering our specific industry, although that's changing now. I've been saying that for a few years. And as I'm saying it, I'm starting to notice younger people entering our industry. But still, I have to think that many engineers graduate with enough knowledge to enter our marketplace and other marketplaces for that matter, but have little knowledge of cleaning processes, probably because they're not going to Sam Houston University and taking the courses. But in our world of the electronics world, the flux bottle says no clean on it. Almost like an instruction,
yeah.
Like might as well say don't clean. What it really should say is low residue and let the user determine whether it needs to be cleaned. But that being said, the flux bottle says no clean. So many engineers believe that they're doing something wrong if they have to clean it, that they're admitting defeat. And so how unusual is it to teach cleaning in a university setting? I mean, obviously you're doing it, but that I get the feeling that's not the norm.
No. And in fact, it's very easy here because we're in the chemistry department. So we don't have, you know, these aren't engineers. These are chemists. They have a traditional chemistry degree. And they are very excited about this area of research because it's applied. And, you know, with the 13 or 14 faculty here in the department, many of them are working on, you know, pure science type projects. And so when the students, you know, hear that this can be applied to electronic circuits or artificial knees or, you know, any aerospace components, liquid oxygen systems, you can just see their eyes light up because now we're talking about things I've seen on the news, or my aunt has an artificial knee. I mean, we know about these products and they really realize the importance of cleaning. So it's a very easy sell here.
Right. Speaking of the news, you know, our industry, the cleaning industry, your industry, my industry, we don't make the mainstream news that often. That's stuff that goes on way behind the curtain, right?
And yes.
And I was so happy. I mean, it was not a great story, but I was so happy to see a story in 2018 in the mainstream press that BMW had to recall thousands of their i3 electric cars. And the reason they stated, and this again made it to the mainstream news, was that a board in that car was not sufficiently cleaned, and the car would, that board would malfunction. They had some kind of watchdog circuit or something looking over the performance of all the boards, realized that some board wasn't operating properly, so they shut it down. The car would shut down unexpectedly, which is very problematic, right? Depending where you are, when the car decides to shut down. And you know, it's the first time I've read in the public media, in the mainstream media, that things don't go well when they're not cleaned. And I celebrated that. And that makes it into all of my presentations now because it's real world. You know, people understand
that. Exactly.
They don't understand dendritic growth and parasitic leakage and ECM and corrosion and all the other adhesion failures. People don't understand that if they're not in the business. But I think in today's age, cleaning has become more mainstream and better understood on the fringes, not just with the people in the trenches, but people outside of the trenches are starting to get that as well. Do you see that too?
Yes, I do see that. And it's also very easy to explain to just the, you know, person on the street. You know, when you're talking about, my students like that, when they're talking about their research, people can grasp the broader impacts of it.
Yeah.
One thing I always show in terms of the importance of cleaning is liquid oxygen systems and these catastrophic takeoffs with rockets. You know, you've got liquid oxygen hitting some hydrocarbon contamination in a valve, and it blows a hole in that valve, and then you have, you know, the destruction of the payload, which is millions of dollars.
Right, exactly. There's a saying that I like to quote from time to time. You know, we don't have time to do it right, but we'll find time to do it over.
yes.
How does this statement relate to cleaning? Do you see that? Are your students and your attendees of your workshop able to connect those dots between reliability and doing it right the first time?
Well, my students are, because sometimes they'll present the results and, you know, they're not what they need to be, and so they have to do it over. It's not a class that I teach. It's actually the research hours that the students have to do for their degree. They can choose who they work for, and the ones that work for me are in the cleaning research group. And one year I had a contact angle study. We were trying to clean these metal coupons and get a baseline clean. And the facility that we were working with was in a dry area. And they said that we should be able to get a contact angle of about 30 degrees, a water contact angle of 30 degrees to match, you know, what they were getting up there. We could not get these coupons that clean here in the Sam Houston National Forest. There were so many pine compounds in the air. As soon as we pulled them out of the ultrasound, you could just see the contact angle increasing as you put drops on the surface.
Sure. Sure.
Well, one thing that my students noticed is that they could never get even close to 40 degrees. And I told them to redo it. And then the next week, still couldn't do it. I said, please redo it. So they redid it three times. And then they realized, how can we clean these parts if the lab's not clean?
Oh, there you go. Right.
So
cleanliness starts at home,
right? How they were doing, and they had everything off the lab benches. They were wiping everything down. They were cleaning the lab because they realized that they didn't have time to do it over, that they needed to do it right. And so
they need to graduate at some point.
That's right. Right.
So one of the questions I was going to ask you, and you actually did a nice segue to it, was contact angle measurement. I was working with a company. Our largest trade show in North America for the electronic assembly industry is called IPC Apex Expo. It was in San Diego a few weeks ago. And I was asked to be part of a panel where they were discussing contact angle measurements. This particular company has come up with a handheld gun-shaped device, which shoots a, you know, particular pattern of water onto a surface and measures automatically the contact angle to determine the adherability, that's a word I make up, of that substrate for conformal coating, which is a coating that we apply over a board if we don't want the board to be subjected to harsh environments. And that technology is not unique to board assembly. It's used for a number of industries, from painting preparation to anodizing to, you know, metal surfaces, to whatever. And it was surprising for me to hear. I asked him, one of the questions I asked was, well, what's a good contact angle? You know, what should people shoot for? And they said, well, totally depends on the substrate. Sometimes the greater the contact angle, the worse the adhesion. Depends on the target. And there isn't one number, 40 degrees, whatever. There isn't one number that is suitable for every substrate. It is substrate dependent. And that surprised me. And then they explained why in only ways they could. And I think I understood some of it. But contact angle measurement does seem to be a useful tool, not so much for determining if there's ionic contamination on a board, which is what we're concerned about.
But
for adherability, for if you're going to apply a coating to the board, obviously it's there for a reason. You don't want delamination. You want it to stick, you know, forever. Whatever that means. I was surprising to hear of the various contexts that one has to measure that in, and how it was so uniquely substrate dependent. That's your experience as well, I assume.
It is. Yes. It's if you're doing metals, even the different metals will have a particular surface energy, which gives you a different contact angle. If there's any contamination, so environmental contamination like we have here in the forest of South Texas. But then also the solvent that you use. Most of the time they use deionized water, but how well has it been deionized?
Right, so is that it 18 megohm or 1 megohm, right?
Yes, and then also it's useful sometimes to use different solvents. So if you wanted to look at a series of solvents to kind of come up with the measurement of the exact surface energy of that surface, you could use multiple solvents. So there's a lot of variability in the contact angle measurement techniques.
So there's an expression I like to quote: if it works well or tastes good, it's either illegal or fattening. And I understand, Barbara and Ed were saying you're a solvent guy, right?
You're in the
solvent world. So with so many solvents being regulated, what's the future of solvents moving forward? I know that in Southern California, we have an agency, as other states do, called AQMD, Air Quality Management District, and those are typically in urban environments. And in Southern California, we have another agency called South Coast Air Quality Management District, SQAQMD. And I'm convinced that these engineers show up for work, well-intended. They have a calculator on, the only thing on their desk is a calculator with three buttons. And one of the buttons is divide, then there's a two, and there's an equal. Divide by two equals. And their job is to take every federal regulation and just go, well, here it's half. So
yeah,
VOC regulations, for example, 50 grams per liter. But in Southern California, it's 25 grams per liter. And the fact that it's exactly half tells me that either that's a coincidence or they just thought half of the federal level would be a good start. And they don't really measure, you know, their job is to improve the environment and save lives that way. And maybe they're not looking, because all these government agencies are so siloed, maybe they're not looking at the larger picture, which is, you know, if we are using solvents that have been cut off at the knees, so to speak, and they're not as good, what is the consequence of that? You know, maybe the air is cleaner on a smoggy, normally smoggy day, but maybe airplanes are going to fall out of the sky, or defibrillators aren't going to fire off because we're not cleaning it as well, because we've taken all the good stuff that makes a solvent work or any cleaning agent work, and we've limited its ability in order to have, you know, a clearer day in August. So does that ring true in your world?
Oh yeah, I think you've laid it out pretty well, and there's some things that the manufacturers are doing to continue to you know, serve the cleaning industry in this area. And there's a chemical response that they're doing. They're trying to make molecules that have a reactive place in the molecule. You know, when they remove the freons, the thing about the freons is they were so inert that they lasted a long time in the environment, made their way up to the ozone layer.
Sure.
And so they've come back with other molecules that are a little more reactive, and so they get chewed up by oxygen. But if those molecules contribute to photochemical smog, then they're labeled VOCs. And so then they continue to do chemistry and figure out other molecules that react faster than ethylene. That's the benchmark for the smog-producing molecules. And if they react faster than that, then there's a chance that they could be VOC exempt. And so there's a chemical answer to that, and there's still innovation going on at the big solvent manufacturers trying to make creative chemical responses to those VOC regulations. But that's pretty difficult, and if those solvents happen to be produced in small volume, then that means they're very expensive. So that's an expensive solution, at least until volume comes up.
Sure.
But then there's another solution, and that is to go with sealed systems. So try to reduce the releases by using a vacuum or some other kind of totally sealed systems. And so any instrument or equipment manufacturers are responding by making these large cleaning machines, as you're aware of. These sealed systems are, you know, when compared with the new molecules, now you're talking about expense in both directions, either expense with a new chemical or expense with a sealed system.
Yeah, I remember when in the late 80s, 89, when the Montreal Protocol was signed, which stopped the production of certain CFC-based materials. And in our world, boards were, back in those days, ironically, back in those days, all boards were cleaned with very few exceptions. And and most of the most common flux back then was a rosin flux, which meant it probably didn't even need to be cleaned. The components were so far apart back in those days, and rosin, you know, was pretty non-conductive and pretty inert. You know, you argument could be made you didn't even need to clean back then, but all boards were cleaned, and they were cleaned in Freon TMS or 111 trichloroethane. And then when the governments, 11 countries, now all UN countries have ratified it, which is amazing for an environmental treaty.
It really is.
I mean, it's only been two UN, there's only been two treaties ratified by every UN nation country. I think there's, I don't know, 280 countries, whatever the number is, 195.
Yes.
One of them is the Geneva Convention and the other is the Montreal Protocol. And I like to say today, we're such a polarized society, without getting political, we're such a polarized society that I don't think if we decided to introduce a treaty for the world to agree on that says the sun goes up in the morning and goes down at night, nobody would agree with that. You know, we would find reasons not to sign it or sign it and get out of it. But
yeah, I say the same thing with the professors.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, but back then, one of the solutions to the alternative solvents was to still use a vapor degreaser and use these alternative solvents, which at the time didn't work very well. And the requirement for freeboard, the area above the boiling solvent, got higher and higher and higher and higher. And I mean literally higher. And 12 inches of freeboard, which was common in the 90s, you know, became 6 feet of freeboard, and to the point where you needed steps and with handrails to get up to the top of the machine to and a hoist to reach down with the basket of parts. And and that, of course, as you said, has morphed into totally sealed systems. And then you can kind of use whatever you want as long as you can prove it doesn't escape. You used the word chemistry a few times. I just have to, you'll chuckle with this. I was at a symposium many years ago, and one of my German colleagues and friend was speaking, and he said, you know, I just have to complain about you Americans. And he says, you keep using the word chemistry in the wrong context. He goes, you don't fill your machines up with chemistry. You fill your machines up with chemical. They are made through chemistry. He says, quit calling it chemistry in that context, you know, which I thought was funny. Every time I hear the word chemistry, and you used it obviously in the correct context, but so many people say, yeah, you know, what chemistry do you use? No, what chemical do you use?
I don't know why that is, but I've only experienced that in the cleaning sector.
Really? Okay.
You know, I don't use it that way in any other conversation.
Yeah, but you used it in the proper context. You know, chemistry is the science behind it, not the material we put in. But it is funny to hear people say that. So in the electronics world, cleaning has transitioned from solvent-based as the norm. The conventional wisdom was solvent-based, and now the conventional wisdom is aqueous-based, aqueous with chemical additives like saponifiers and other things. Is this occurring in other industries? I know there's certain other industries that can't contact water, you know, for corrosion reasons and whatever. But is there a move to in the general cleaning world to get away from certain solvents or solvents in general and go toward more water-based, aqueous-based solutions?
I think there was, and there may still be. I mean, I think now there's more of an effort to bring in consultants and to see if a move to solvent is actually going to be beneficial to the company, or a move away from solvent is going to be beneficial. Some have moved to aqueous and regretted it because they didn't know of the power costs and the wastewater, you know, release issues and so on. So there, you know, there were some surprises for some companies.
For sure.
And so then they might be considering going back, but it's difficult for me to get a gauge on that. That's where the partnership with the Königsbergs really helps, because they're out there more than I am talking to particular industries.
Yeah, my take on it, and it's non-scientific, it's only anecdotal really, is aqueous is lowercase a, because my company's name is Aqueous, uppercase A, so I'm not meaning a proper noun, I'm meaning a technology, is largely aqueous-based, but in all other or most other parts of the cleaning world, precision cleaning, critical cleaning, it is solvent dominant. That's just been my experience, that solvents are they're not going away. They're going to get quote unquote cleaner or more mm-hmm. controlled, but they're certainly not going away. In the electronics world, there was a bunch of studies during the phase out of CFCs called a phase two study, and they benchmarked, I think, 111 trichloroethane against a bunch of aqueous things, and they came up with one of three categories: worse than, same as, or better than, using the 111 trichloroethane as the benchmark. And pretty much anything submitted got better than, which to a lot of people was a surprise. But then again, in our world, back when solvent was common, if there was a conformal coating process going to go on, or if something was going to go up into space or needed to be cleaner than clean, then they would solvent clean everything and then do a high-quality DI water rinse afterwards just to polish up the cleanliness a little bit, let the solvent do the heavy lifting, and then use water to do the final cleaning. That was kind of a norm. So we just kind of skipped the solvent, went right to the final water cleaning results in that case. But I don't think that could be used on a lot of metal. I don't think that could be used on other types of contaminant species.
Well, they have to bring in different tanks and different sprays, you know, put on a rust preventative and so on.
Sure.
And so then that's where when I said capture your cleaning process, that's a part of it. You know, what kind of rust preventative do we need on this part? Will it last a week or a month or indefinitely? And they make all different kinds. So these are the decisions that the manager has to make.
So here's a question that probably has an impossible answer, but I get asked it all the time, so it's only fair you get asked it today. How clean is clean enough? What do you tell your clients, your students? You know, when do you stop cleaning?
Well, we do a lot of cleanliness studies here, and you know, we would really like to get back to our baseline. So we'll set things up. We'll have a control. And we'll see, you know, just for our purposes, can we get back to what it was before we soiled it? And so that's an easy answer. We have a control. Can we get back to our control level of cleanliness? And so that's pretty difficult sometimes. Oh, you wouldn't believe it, but one of the most challenging soils to test your aqueous cleaning line with is Sharpie marker on a frosted glass microscope slide.
Because the frosted glass absorbs or
it holds on to that ink. Yeah. And the Sharpie formulation has got some carbon black in it. It's been difficult to kind of figure out what is in that, but we've been doing work with it. It's got some sort of carbon black particulate pigment and then a polymer binder that is dissolved in a solvent. So you rub that on a frosted glass area, you've got particles. And you've got a residue that's polymeric, and the solvent leaves it behind. So it seals those particles into all those nooks and crannies. And that's pretty tricky to clean off. And so we've been challenging different cleaning formulations in ultrasonic tanks and looking at different temperatures. And our goal for cleaning is to get back to that control, you know, the unmarked microscope slide. And it's pretty tough. We can get easily down to 10% residue left, at least on an optical density. We take photographs of these and we look at how bright that frosted glass area is, and we can get 90% of it off pretty easily. Is that going to be good enough for the next process step? I don't know. And that's where you need to talk to your customer. Is this clean enough for your purposes?
Right. It's definitely a relative answer. And that kind of brings in the subject of not just the chemical required, the agent required to solubilize, if that's what it's doing, but the mechanical attributes of that too. It's getting that chemical into the pores, if you will, or under the component, or in the blind vias, or whatever the case may be. That's a whole nother element of the cleaning process, not just the chemical, but delivering the chemical to where it needs to go with the right energy and impingement and all of that. That's one thing I think chemicals really do well in, because of their inherent low surface tension compared to water.
Yes.
That they have an easier ability to get into those crevices. But still, it comes down to a marriage, a choreography between the chemical and the mechanical.
Yes.
And not all chemicals are compatible with all mechanical delivery systems. And so there has to be a balance there. Let's talk about the workshop that's coming up. It's very unusual in my world. You know, we produce workshops all the time, but you know, we have a horse in the race. And what's very unusual is to see a cleaning workshop from neutral parties without a horse in the race. You're not trying to, other than getting them in for the curriculum, you're not trying to sell them a solution. So it's completely unbiased. So tell me a little bit about the product quality cleaning workshop. And just for our audience sake, it's May 13th through 14th at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas. Don't go to Alabama. Huntsville, Texas. So tell me the genesis of that workshop and what kind of people attend, what you teach, what people will take away from that.
Well, I came up with the idea in talking with Barbara and Ed Koenigsberg at the different parts cleaning conferences hosted by Gardner. And so as we talked and gave our talks, we had many people after our talks asking more questions and so on. And we thought, you know, we really do need to do a workshop because we think it's critical. It's a critical need in the industry. Not only for people who've been in the industry for a while, say you're an aqueous person and you know that forwards and backwards, but now you've got a process that may require solvent. Where do you find how do you come up to speed on a solvent process? Well, this workshop would allow you to get that because we're going to cover everything. Aqueous and solvent, we'll cover ultrasonic agitation, we'll cover vacuum cycle cavitation, CO2 snow and plasma. I mean, we'll get into all the different techniques. And it's made for manufacturers, for managers, and technicians to come in and get a comprehensive view of cleaning. Now, the exciting thing about it is hosted at a university, which means we have access to the laboratories. So we get to go in and do a hands-on, you know, testing. You'll get to look at the foil test and an ultrasound, and you can see how easy it is to perform. You'll get to see vapor degreasing in action and vacuum cycle cavitation. So there's lots of hands-on activities. We have two lab sessions each day, so you'll get in the lab four times on the workshop.
Wow, that's good. That's way more than theoretical.
Yes. It's also not really it's a small workshop because of the lab. I mean, we really have a max 50 to 60 seats because, you know, we only have so much lab space. Mm-hmm. And so, it's meant for you to come and build relationships with those other people that are at the workshop. So whether it's sponsors or attendees, you're all in the same classroom together. You're all in the labs together. And our goal is for you to build contacts within the industry so that you can call people and they'll pick up. They'll know who's calling.
So the takeaways are, this is hands-on. This is not in a lecture hall. This is actually in a real lab. Seating is limited because of the size of the lab. So if you're interested in attending this event, book early or go next year. So if you want to go this year, book early. And it from the reviews I've read and from the material that I've read on it and the pictures of real hands-on stuff, it looks quite valuable. And any time someone can learn about cleaning, which again is so far behind the curtain, most people don't even think about that. I think that is very well worthwhile. So I strongly encourage our audience, if they want to learn more about cleaning, from solvents to aqueous to all sorts of different angles of attack, so to speak, this is probably one of the only, or at least few, I think only, events where you can get that kind of information in a safe environment where people aren't going to try and sell you solutions and all this stuff. And I know Barbara and Ed bring a lot of value to it from their perspective. They've been on this earth preaching cleaning for a very long time, as have you. And so you're going to get some academic perspective and some real world perspective. And it sounds like something that will worthwhile.
Yes, it's going to be great.
Thank you so much for spending some time with me today. Our audience will definitely gain some good perspective on cleaning. well beyond the narrow scope that we normally talk about. So I really appreciate that. And I wish you all the luck in the world. I don't think you need it, but all the luck in the world at the Product Quality Cleaning Workshop. This is what the, is it the, like the third one you've done, or how many have you done?
This is the second one. Second We've been one. Doing it every other year. The Parts Cleaning Conference has been in the spring of odd calendar years. And so we decided to do our workshop in the spring of even calendar years.
Okay, got it. Well, thank you again for joining me today. And I'll put information for those of you who are listening. If you want to get information on the quality workshop, go to the show notes. I'll have a link to the registration page and other information right there. Dr. Williams, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a great pleasure, and I appreciate everything that you do.
Thank you. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. Reliability Matters and other reliability-based podcasts are available at Circuit Assembly's PCB Chat at pcbchat.com and at Ascendo Reliability at reliability.fm. Thanks for your comments. Please keep them coming. Send comments and episode suggestions to Mike at mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.